This is Virginia Emmerich of Louisville, Kentucky Unit of Women's Overseas Service League on March 23, 1984. I'm going to interview Virginia Emmerman, who was in the WAC Army Corps in World War II. Virginia, tell me something about what you were doing before you entered the service and why you entered it.
I was living in a small town where I grew up outside of Boston, Massachusetts. And I had graduated from high school and eventually went to business college. And I was working as a secretary at the American Unitarian Association. As the war went on and they started to draft married men, and life at home became rather boring and lonesome, I decided that I would join the service. I was given a choice of what branch I wished to serve in, and I chose the Air Force, which at that time was part of the Army. I was sent to Fort Oglethorpe in Chattanooga, Tennessee for basic training. And from there I was shipped to Love Field in Dallas, Texas. This was my first experience of traveling outside of New England and meeting girls, women, from especially the South or other parts of the country. I worked at Love Field for a very short time in the Adjutant General's office. I kept wanting to go overseas. When I saw a requisition for women to fill overseas contingents, I would ask a person I knew in personnel to try to get me on the list. I finally managed to be put on a shipment. I left with Dallas with one other girl, Mildred Ramey from Overland, Missouri, with a delay en route to visit my family in Boston before leaving for overseas. Our group came from all over the United States to Grenier Field in Manchester, New Hampshire. The only other girl I knew was one from Boston who had taken the entrance physical in Boston when I did. By the time we were ready to ship out, I knew the name of every girl from listening to their names and seeing them be handed their mail at mail call every day. There were approximately 150 girls in our company. It was part of the Air Transport Command. While we were at Grenier Field, we made trips into town to stock up on cosmetics, and all who needed to made a trip to the Post Beauty Parlor for a permanent, since we had no idea that we would be able to do this where we were going. We were not told where we were going, and there was a certain amount of trepidation about what it would be like there. When we finally were loaded on the train in Manchester, we knew we were heading for Florida. I had never been to the real South. We were a troop train and went on a very roundabout route. The train was our home for several days and nights, and the girls sang with the porters to while the time away. Chattanooga Choo Choo was the favorite song. I remember getting off the train one night for a brief stopover and walking down to see the Mississippi River for the first time. We saw the dark shacks in which black people lived and which we had only seen in pictures. We got off the train in North Carolina for breakfast in a restaurant with immaculate white tablecloths and charming black waiters serving coffee from silver pots. I felt I was in the South for the first time. Finally, we came into Hanging Moss Country. I remember how thrilling it was to look out the window and see the moss hanging just as I had pictured it to be. We were offloaded at some backwater place outside of Miami. I remember our consternation when we were expected to heave our heavy baggage into the trucks. The bags were really packed tightly. We had jumped up and down on each layer to get everything in, and they were very heavy. Our training had not been very rigorous, but somehow we got loaded up and were taken to a Spanish-style hotel, the Floridian, on Biscayne Bay. We shared that hotel with officers and various civilians waiting to go overseas. Down the street, the enlisted men were billeted at another big hotel, the Fleetwood. Finally, I was put on alert, which meant that I could not leave the hotel grounds. We stopped off in Puerto Rico at Barrincon Field. We still did not know where we were going. We made short stops in Georgetown and in Belém, in South America. And we did see some freight marked Karachi on our plane. Somewhere the rumor had started that we were going to Africa. Our next stop was Natal, where many of the girls were still waiting to be shipped out. But I was shipped out the very next day after I arrived. We had to stop on Ascension Island, which was rather scary because they had a saying, "Miss Ascension and your wife gets a pension." Indeed, several planes coming and going had crashed there. We were very hospitably received on the base in Accra. It was very hot there, and except for the rainy season, which we had missed, the sun shone all the time. Our buildings where we worked and lived were thick concrete blocks and were fairly comfortable.
Let me ask you this. Did you have to have any special shots or anything for your being located in Africa? What did you have to do as preventive medicine? Can you, yes, just tell me.
We had to take Advil tablets.
Oh, is that all? Well,
we had regular shots, I'm sure, before we left.
Uh-huh.
But we had to take Advil tablets. We also able to take salt tablets too, which did help.
Mm-hmm.
One time I thought if one was good, two was better, and I got very sick. We didn't really know how to handle those. But that was the one thing, was the Ativan tablets, and wearing, at night we had to wear leggings, which were very ugly, but you could not go out without them.
Because of the mosquitoes. I see. Well, I know practically every area had a different setup of shots or some preparation for it. I just wondered in your case. All right.
I was assigned to work in the quartermaster office. I remember the first day going to the office where I was to work, seeing a native man striding along with a typewriter on his head. We had a native young man who did typing in our office. He used to come in and warm up just like a concert pianist. He also used to bring in raw diamonds, and people would buy them.
Well, African diamonds.
And for snacks, we had freshly roasted peanuts and bananas, which grew there.
Homegrown. What about your laundry facilities and other things?
Life was very, very good there. We had laundry, no limit to how much you could send, which was a great thing. Of course, it would have to be that way because of the heat. We had native men who served as waiters in mess hall, and we had native girls who did our chores in the rooms. So we had no KP or that kind of duty.
Did you have to supply any of the implements, for instance, your soaps and such things that, or was this something that the Army took care of for our wax?
I don't remember them that we had to supply anything.
Well, different services had different ways of doing things.
We even eventually had a beauty parlor there. After we got there, they sent to a beautician, and we had our own beauty parlor.
Native or a member of the
American, a member of the WAC.
I see. Well, you were lucky.
Yes.
All right.
The Air Transport Command always went first class. They were sometimes called the Army of Terrified Civilians or Allergic to Combat, but they really did have very good facilities, and we were different from the other services.
I see. I'm getting the picture now.
We were there with the British, and they used to, we had a moving picture, outdoor moving picture theater, and they used to come there, and we sometimes did things with the British. The WACs were very popular in the town with the native people.
All right, when you say you with the British, do you mean people, civilians, or the army, the military?
Well,
British?
They had civilians in town because it was then British West Africa, but they also had military people there. They were not on our base, but they used to come in trucks to our movies and so forth.
I see.
So they could use some of our facilities.
Did you have many social occasions that you were with them?
No.
I see.
We didn't. We only had 150 women, and there were, goodness knows how many American soldiers, and there weren't enough women to go around.
Right.
As far as social affairs were concerned.
I see. All right.
We had a PX where there was music and dancing, and they served a craw beer until American beer, remember, it was during the war that they made it legal.
3.2.
And there was an officers' club there, but of course the enlisted women were not allowed to mingle with officers. But they let us have the club once a month for a big dance where the enlisted men and the women went. As a matter of fact, we had two dances where we wore formal dresses until they.
And how did you get those formal dresses?
Okay, some of them were made by Native women in town. One of my best friends had a beautiful lace dress made by a Native. Well, I think she was maybe French. There were a few French people. Some of them sent home for their dresses. My dress was made there by a WAC. I had a flowered skirt, and I had a white blouse that she made. And I wore Native sandals that were made out of old automobile tires, but they looked very nice. You know, they were painted, and they were very attractive.
Yes,
and it was a better kind of outfit to wear because it was so hot. Some of those chiffon dresses just did not stand up in that terrible heat, and I was very comfortable.
While we're on the subject of clothes, how regulated were you for uniform during the day?
We had strict uniform regulations. The men there quite often wore shorts with knee socks, and we wore skirts and tops with boots. They were high boots.
Let's see. Did you wear pants at any time in your
service? We were never issued pants. Evidently, the Army was short of money, or it was, you know, right at the time when the war effort was going full blast, and there were shortages, and we never were issued pants. Some of the girls bought men's pants in the PX. I never did. But it would have been nice if we had them. Then you wouldn't have to wear those pup tents. But I think I didn't mind what we wore because of the good laundry service. I had a clean uniform every day. Mm. We did have to have mosquito nettings over our bed.
Oh, yeah.
And whether it made it hotter or not, I don't know, but it certainly made you think it was. And some of the girls would try to get away with not having them down, but it was considered an offense. Then you were punished if you were caught.
Did you have any fever, anything that anybody in the company might have gotten because of mosquitoes?
Not that I know of. The only thing that we got, and I got a touch of it, but it got I lost it as soon as I went north, was what they used to call jungle rot. It was some sort of an infection that you got on your hands and feet, and it could get very ugly. And I guess it got in some people's ears. And I heard later that some of the girls actually had to go home and go to the hospital. And mine went away as soon as I got to England.
Well, oh, that's interesting. All right, did I interrupt you there at a good moment?
Well, I don't remember what we were saying.
Is there a place among your notes that you might pick up?
Well, we did work hard every day, but we had very good food, except that we lacked milk and butter. We didn't have any milk and butter. Some of the people would go into town and eat, but I never ate in there because the town was very interesting, but it smelled very bad.
Did you use your American money, or did you have an issue special for Africa?
We used. Remember, I think we used the British West African money, which was like the British money. That's right. Yes, we didn't use American. I've forgotten about that. We had a beautiful beach there. It was very heavy surf, and you didn't swim in it. The native people were guards because the surf was so rough. They were able to swim in it, but most of the Americans couldn't handle it. We were not allowed to stray very far from the limits set for us. One day, a friend and I went on a picnic that was beyond the limits. There were two men from Standard Oil or something they were young men who took us on a picnic. They lived in town. And we brought the dishes after the picnic down to the ocean to wash, and every single dish was washed. That's how rough the sea was.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing a little boy there, and he must have had elephantiasis because he had one of his huge toe, you know, just huge, so he must have. The natives, you see, we were not really supposed to be there. We're very friendly, though, and one of them, or two of them, or several of them, they had canoes that they made themselves, and they took us out beyond the surf in these canoes for nothing, just that we would take their picture. They were so,
friendship.
They really liked us, you know.
Wow.
And most of the girls, after they were in Accra for a short time, went steady with young men. There were choices all over the place, but I think it's rather interesting that most of them settled on one person.
And, yeah.
We had two weddings in full regalia there at the base.
How did they get all the things for the wedding?
One of the girls, her dress was made by another WAC, and it was a beautiful white lace dress.
Yeah.
It was a very nice wedding in the chapel. I remember I was supposed to have a date that night, and I went to the wedding, and the young man came, and I wasn't there. I had just gone, you know, on the spur of the moment. She was a friend of mine. I don't know what the other girl wore, but there were ways of getting things. There were people who could sew in town, and then you could send for things.
All right. Well, what happened to the couple after they were married? Were they separated, sent back to their separate units, or were they still close to each other?
Well, one of the couples, they were both stationed there. The other couple, I think he was sent back. We had one girl in our group who was married, and they eventually, her husband was in the air transport command too at one of the line stations up further toward in the desert, and they sent him to our base. So
could they live together?
I don't think they could live together, but they did send them to the base because they were married. I don't know what they did, really. And unfortunately, she was one of the girls who was crashed in the plane. Her name was Greta Friend. After VE Day, work at the base began to wind down. It had really been built up to bring the big planes back from China, Burma, India. That is probably why we were brought in too. You know, they built it up, and then as they were coming back, it was winding down. And the WACs were given a choice. They could go back to the States or go to headquarters in London.
And where did you ask to go?
I chose to go on. Mm-hmm. We were sent out in groups, and I was on one of the first flights, and we went to London first. That's where the headquarters were. Some of the girls were not in headquarters, but I was always in headquarters. And we were sent to, first we went to Bovingdon, which is the old 8th Air Force Base. And that was an experience for us because there were no amenities there. We had to ask the highest ranking sergeant for toilet paper, and she had to measure it out, and it was very cold. We actually slept in our boots and hats the first night. It was not too pleasant there. We weren't there very long. The only recreation, you could go off through the fields, which were typical English fields. You crossed over a stile, and there was a bull in the field, to a pub that was probably several miles away. So if you liked to drink beer, but that was the only thing going at that base at that time. So we were glad when they shipped us into London. And I was you were sent to personnel, and you really got a choice of jobs, and they had a choice of you. And I took a job in the special projects office.
What is special projects?
Well, special projects can be various things. At one time, they handled, for instance, they were doing secret dropping of equipment into the Scandinavian countries. I think there was a man named, he was an Air Force pilot named Bernd Balken, who was in charge of that. And he did it through that office. Now, he was long gone after, you know, when I got there. This was during the war. They did all sorts of special things. And by the time I got there, as the war was, you know, VE Day had been finished in Europe. Japanese war was still going on. But in Europe, what they were doing, the Air Transport Command was going to all the air bases. And I'm sure that probably we were giving the countries equipment to enlarge the air bases. And for instance, when I got to Orly Field, it was nothing, and now it is a big base. And they would survey the fields and report back to the United States of what was available there and what was needed. And most of my work was typing up the reports that the various field people who visited all the bases in Holland and all over Europe.
Are you saying that the American military left supplies and left machinery, perhaps, or left things to make a bigger field, a more efficient running organization for the country?
I have a feeling that they were doing that, yes. I really, you know, it's pretty hard to remember exactly what was happening. I know they were surveying the field, saying what was needed and what was already there.
But this was for use after the American military had left. Is that correct?
This was after VE Day. Now, there were still military.
I mean, they weren't
Europe.
Preparing the field or whatever the location was.
Not for war, they were preparing for peace.
For peace. You suppose they had in mind the occupation army?
I think so, partly
America.
It was occupation, because there was an occupation army there.
I see.
It was looking toward the future. I'm sure it was coordinated with all sorts of things, probably the Marshall Plan and everything, because they, the airfields did need to be conditioned and so forth and improved. And that was part of it also was what the Russians were doing in these various places. The people out in the field would come in and dictate these reports, which I would type. And they were trying to soft pedal the fact that there were beginning to be differences between the Russians and the Americans, and there were beginning to be suspicions and so forth. And some of these things came out in the reports, but it always seemed to me that they were trying not to really spell it out, that they were hinting at it more than anything else. But there were signs that there was animosity and things going on.
That's very interesting, yes. I wondered, the Marshall Plan was something I had in mind, but I didn't know it actually started that early, immediately after VE Day. I thought it was.
Well, I don't know whether it was in effect, but I'm sure that the pre-planning was probably. I'm sure right away they knew they were going to have to do something. You know, just as like they had to do something for the people who were in the camps and for the people who were food and so forth. I'm sure they were doing things like that.
So you're saying that a good side of it was that Americans didn't just walk out and leave a place that they had taken over totally at a loss for the people who were native of that area. They did try to do something for them.
Well, I don't know what their reasons were, but they were. I'll tell you, I was not as politically aware then. I had not been to college. I was young then. And I was more interested in, life and what was happening around me. And I really was not politically aware. Mm-hmm. So that is probably one of the reasons why I can't tell you exactly what was happening. Now if I were working in the office, I'd really know. We also had the French liaison officer in our office in Paris. He was one of the Rothschilds. He told me he's one of the poorer ones. And I remember, I hate to tell you this, I remember one of his jobs was to get Simone to come to the March of Dimes ball. That was one of his assignments. I never could tell what he was doing.
Simone came to Louisville, to the University of Louisville,
really?
I was around the Playhouse.
Oh,
yes,
really?
I wanted to enter that. I had a chance to meet her, too. But
that's what we were doing, and I lived at a small hotel right near the Arc de Triomphe, and our offices were in the Astoria Hotel, which later became Eisenhower's headquarters when he came to Paris, and then I believe it eventually became the drugstore, and then it burned down.
Well, in Paris, did you have freedom on your days off or your time off to go most any place you wanted?
We had all kinds of freedom. They did tell us that probably we shouldn't eat in the restaurants because the French people were still having problems with food. And so they discouraged us from eating in the restaurants. But we did all sorts of things. We went to the Folies Bergères. I went to the theater the first night that Maurice Chevalier performed in Paris after the war. There were men still being brought back from Germany who had been slave labor or labor in Germany, because you would hear the trucks going.
French people being returned.
Trucks going through the streets, and they would be singing, and I said, "Who are they?" And they said, "Well, they're still coming back from Germany." But the metro was running, and we could go anywhere. We used to go to the flea market. What else did we do? I had a friend whose mother was French and had married an American soldier during World War I. The girl had been born of a French father who had been killed in World War I, and then her mother had married an American soldier. And so she was in our Accra company and was a good friend of mine. But then she was sent right on to Paris because she spoke such good French. And she had looked up very laboriously all her old relatives, you know, because she had lost track of them during the war. And I used to go to dinner at their house with her.
Did you speak French?
I spoke a little bit. I had taken French in school, but I was not that good, but I was one of the few. She said that's why she used to take me. I was one of the few. I'd try anyway. And as a matter of fact, her nephew, her cousin, who was about our age, maybe a little younger, he and I would try to talk. He would try to talk English, and I would try to talk French. We would walk back to the metro at night after supper, and we would stumble along in each other's language. And we've always been interested, you know, I used to get cards from him, and my mother told me when he got married and had children, and I got married, and I told her, and he eventually died recently. So we always sort of kept in touch.
And what was the total time you were in Paris, approximately?
Let's see. I was probably in Paris a year and a half, I would say.
I see.
We were there until, at first they sent the married women home, and then they sent the people home who had lots of points, who had been in the service a long time. And then eventually the group that I was there were sent home, and they weren't going to have WACs there anymore, or not a real company. Some of the girls stayed on as civilians. You could do that.
Virginia, did you have any opportunity to see any of the other countries while you were in Europe?
Oh yes, we were. There were several trips to go on. For some reason, I never got that much leave. I always am stuck in a job where I never get the time that everybody. Some of the girls went down to Biarritz. One girl went to Ireland. I forgot to say that when I was in London, I went to Bournemouth to visit the mother of my aunt's husband.
Oh.
She lived in Bournemouth. And I spent 2 or 3 days there, and I found out how the progression of meals is there. When you get up in the morning, they have a thing to make coffee or tea right at the bedside, and you have the tea and crackers, and then you get dressed and go down and you have some breakfast, and then you can have lunch, and then you have a big tea very late in the afternoon, and then you just can have something later or not. So that was rather interesting to find out. And she tried to make coffee for me, and they're not all that good at making coffee. And she just took the coffee grounds and put boiling water on it, you know. But she was a delightful person, and she took me down, that's right on the ocean, down to the place down there. I remember that was at the period when it was hard to get stockings. They had really run out of stockings. And my mother had sent me a pair of stockings from the United States.
Were they nylon or silk?
They were probably rayon by that time. I don't think you were getting any silk or nylon. And I had saved them for just an occasion like this. And when we started walking through the park, I remember it was filled with Canadian Air Force men on leave. My stockings started to droop, and I kept pulling them. And the more I pulled them, the longer they got. And I just couldn't control them. And my dear lady that I was with said, "What's the matter, Virginia? Have you got a ladder in your hose?" And I eventually had to sit down and take those stockings off. They
did you
were
know what she meant by a ladder?
Yes,
at first?
I knew.
Oh, did you?
Yes, I knew that. But I'll never forget those awful stockings. But I did get to go to Brussels, and they seemed to have plenty of food there. And we went to see all the things that you hear about, the little boy, the little statue.
Oh, yeah.
And I found it easier to understand the French that they spoke there. I think it's because they also speak German, and it's not as liquid. And I could understand their French much better.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell this, and you probably maybe want to erase it. But they would give you a penny. We didn't have money. And they gave you a penny. You could get on the trolley car and go to the place where you could change your money. And the trolley car ran through the center of Brussels, a very long street. And we got on and we couldn't see anything, you know, and we were worried that we had missed it. And every time we would see the U.S., we would get off and we didn't have any more money, and it would always be a United States prophylactic station.
I don't know where they got that, but that's all right.
And we were so embarrassed. We saw the sign U.S. and all along, you know, and we kept getting off and we didn't have any money, and the man would give us a penny, we'd get back on again. We finally got to where we were to get our money.
Well, that brings up another question. Was this an education to you, the life that you had with the wax, or were you cognizant of a lot of things that you saw going on over there? Did you approve of everything that you saw, or not?
Well, for some reason, my naivete remained with me. I really didn't, I was a very naive and virginal person when I went in the service. And I know that there were some things that surprised me a little bit, because I was very fussy about who I took up with, you know, and so forth. But I would see other girls behaving differently. Most of the girls that I was in the company with were very nice. It was just like a group of college girls, as a matter of fact. I know there were things that went on, but I didn't really, none of my friends were involved, and I don't think I realized what life was all about. It took a lot longer. The only thing I do remember, I remember some of the officers who, I know one in particular, he had been in Germany for years, and he got back. He had been in our office, and he had been sent over during the fighting, and came back. And I remember he was going to see his British girlfriend, who had been there, and he kept saying what a wonderful girl she was and how appreciative. And yet he was also calling his wife at home, and when his wife got on, he was crying. And I think I realized then that men quite often have a dual life. I saw quite a bit of that. Yeah. They said they cleared out the officers' club when the dependents started coming in, and it was quite interesting.
But did you run into any animosities either among natives of the countries where you were, or in among service people in any way? Did any of the men ever resent having women on the base, or women overseas even?
I didn't run into any animosity anywhere. I loved the British, and they were always wanting to show us things and be friendly with us. I loved the French. One man got off the metro and walked all the way off several streets down to show us where the flea market was. I got a lot of attention in France because I was tall and had blonde hair. And they were always, you know, trying to help me. And the natives in Africa just loved us. Now, there were some who were in the town. I remember one time walking along and seeing a woman cooking over a stove, and she had a knife in her hand, and she threw it when we went by, so she didn't like us. But the ones that we came in contact, we did. I didn't find any animosity. Most of the men really liked us. The strangest thing, one time we went to Camp Philip Morris. We went down to Antwerp or someplace, and it was the big base where all the men were waiting to get home. And we walked in there, and not a single one looked up. There were acres and acres of men waiting to go home. Not one looked up, and we weren't used to that, you know. Oh. I guess it was.
Was there a reason that you
found out? We don't know. We were both surprised. You know, we only went in there to get coffee or something. You know, in Europe, when we were there, you could go down to the railroad station at the RTO, and we either rode free on the trains or we paid a very small amount. It was called the RTO, and you could go anywhere on the RTO. Americans could do that. Mm-hmm. And we went to Antwerp one day. I remember it was pouring rain in France and in Paris, And we wanted to get away, and we had a day off, this friend and I. And when we went to the railroad station, we didn't know where we wanted to go. And we were talking to him. He said, well, you know, it's raining there, too, you know. Yeah. We said, well, anywhere, we'll go. We went to Antwerp, anyway.
Yeah. Well, now, from England, after you left, or when did you leave England, and under what circumstances?
The headquarters was moving to Paris. And the night that I arrived in Paris was VJ night. And I had waited, we had been waiting at Bovington Airport, I think it was. All day there was some mix up in the plane, and everything was, probably, maybe it was because it was VJ day, I don't know, but we had a long wait for our plane, and we were there all day long. I remember Raymond Massey being in the airport waiting for his plane, too. And I also remember...
Was he in uniform?
I don't know whether he was in special services or not. I just remember him. He didn't have an army uniform. Mm-hmm. But I remember sitting at the coffee counter and talking to some young men who were soldiers coming back from Germany. And I started... They talked to me, and I was talking to them, and one of them started to cry. He had been an infantryman, and they had been in German prison camp. One of the boys, you know, was very cheerful and everything, but the other one started to cry, and I didn't, you know why. And the other friend, who seemed to take care of him, was telling all about their experiences in the camp. And he said that the boy who was crying had not heard from his family since he had been gone, and he was just worried. You know, that was the first thing they all did as soon as they got out, was to telephone. Yeah. I mean, you couldn't get in line to get a telephone. But I remember the cheerful one told about trying to make a cake out of these small packets of things that the Red Cross would send every now and then, sugar and whatever. Yeah. He didn't know how to make a cake or anything, but none of them had had a cake for so long in this German prison camp, and he tried to make a cake. And he evidently was, you know, the kind who made the most of a bad situation. But I remember being very shook by the young man who had tears falling down in his eyes.
Were there any moments that you felt that you were in danger, or that something awesome might have happened?
We were never in danger as far as I know. A group of girls from Accra who came in the plane after us, and one of them was my roommate, went down. They never found any trace of them.
At what point was the plane?
It was off the coast of, it was probably called Dakar then. It was off the coast of Africa. It hadn't gone terribly far.
Into the water.
Yeah, like. It went down. They called in a mayday. And we were in Casablanca when we got word of it. And we later found out that they used to send out searching parties. All the girls who were still on the base and the men would go out, you could volunteer, and they went on searching parties, and they never found any trace of the girls. And there were 18 mm-hmm. girls on that. We later had a service for them in London, mm-hmm. in the chapel in London.
I'm searching for. Was your you said you were lucky in most of the time in your housing and the place where you stayed or were billeted, that followed all the way through your service?
Most of the. We had regular billets in Love Field, you did KP. Part of the reason I was lucky, because my name began with O. Some places you go, they start at the beginning of the alphabet, and other places they start at the end, and I'm in the middle, so I missed it a lot of times.
Which reminds me, did you mention that you were O'Rourke at the time you were in service?
I forgot to say that.
I think you did, yes. So it's a good time to introduce that as your maiden name, and Immerman as your married name.
Yes.
Can you think of any more memorable occasions while you were on location, so to speak, or in Europe, while you were in the service?
No, except that the trip to Switzerland was very very exciting and interesting.
With whom did you go to?
I went with a girl who you just signed up for them, and then when I went with a girl who lived in my barracks, or not my barracks, in my hotel suite. I had a hotel suite. That's
well, you did live well.
Yes, I had my single bed in one little room, and we had French paintings. It was very nice. They had the extra piece of plumbing there, and you could take a bath. The only thing was that the electricity wasn't always too reliable, and you would quite often be right in the middle of getting dressed to go out on a date or taking a bath, and the lights would all go out.
Did you get used to having candles or lighting candles?
Well,
or
didn't, we didn't. We just waited, and it went back on again.
They were.
And we had the people in, it was a small hotel, and the regular staff were still working there. Who I later met them when I went back to visit. They were still there. They would do anything for you for 2 cigarettes. That was our tip. And they thought we were really great, you know. And 2 cigarettes was the tip.
By the way, did you have an issue of cigarettes, or did you have to buy your cigarettes?
You had an allotment on a card that they... and I never black marketed. Now, I know that a lot of people did. Most everybody did. But I don't know. I never did. I used to give my cigarettes and candy and extra things to this French family that I used to go visit a lot, but I never black marketed.
Did you have a liquor ration?
No, I don't think we did. I don't remember having any beer.
Did you, for the most part, get whatever a man in the same position in the Army would have gotten, or whatever was issued to the men? Did the women also have the same in the well, like their cigarettes.
I'm sure we did. Never came up. We were very separate from them.
I see.
Although the men did used to eat in our mess in Paris. They weren't billeted with us, but they ate in our mess.
Maybe they were guests of
they ate regularly with us because we had formed some really good friendships. Quite often the men would be able to get a vehicle, you know, a military vehicle, and we went to the Bois de Boulogne, and we went on trips to Versailles. I have pictures of us going to Versailles. I was in the Louvre the first day that the Venus de Milo was on display. I remember being kind of wondering why so much was made of it, you know. We just had a really good time. And then in Switzerland, you had a choice of places, but if you weren't one of the first ones to choose, you had to take what was left. And we ended up on a skiing tour, and I didn't ski, and neither did my friend. But we, you got free, you got your hotel, your travel, and your food, and free ski equipment, and free ski instruction.
Oh.
Because Switzerland was trying to get
good.
A lot of things were done, I'm sure, to get these countries back on their feet again, because the Switzerland had not had, the hotels had not had people there, and for all those years, not very many people. And the food in Switzerland was just out of this world. It was so rich. I remember whipped cream on things. And they just made of us, like, you know, they just... And we did go out skiing, although I wasn't very good, but there was one boy with us who was on the 20th Mountain Ski Team, and another boy from New York, he learned to ski, I remember. And at the end of the trip, you were supposed to go up on the Gornegrat and ski down, but by that time I had given up.
Well, in other words, usually the opportunities for service are while in the service were the same for men and women.
I'm sure. And as a matter of fact, the men complained because they were in an old castle out in the country at one time, and they weren't in town. And they eventually, they wrote letters to Yank magazine, and they fussed so much they eventually brought them in town. So actually, we were lots of times we were treated a little better than the men. Sometimes when we were traveling, we'd eat in the officers' mess. We were billeted in officers' barracks. Why, I don't know. We were treated better than the men because there were fewer of us, and I suppose they just couldn't throw us in with the men, and they didn't have facilities for women, so we quite often were treated the way the Red Cross or the officers were treated.
Did you all have R&R, or were you there long enough to go on leaves, recreation?
Well, they didn't call it R&R, but you had leaves. It's all set up. After you've worked a certain length of time, you have a certain amount of leave coming to
you. Is that the way you saw most of the places?
Yes, or you get three-day passes. For instance, if you wanted to go to Brussels, you would have a three-day pass. They would go to Biarritz on a three-day pass. You would have to take a week's leave probably to go to Switzerland. So,
do you know of any great changes that have taken place among women in service? I don't know whether you're familiar with any of the recent WACs. Have you heard of any rules, regulations being changed that you thought were better or not as good or anything like that?
I don't really know what the present day Army is like. I imagine they have more freedom because the men seem to have more freedom. Of course, it was during wartime too, and things are different during wartime. The things that I remember, you had to have your hair above your collar. That was everything. Everybody wanted long hair when they first got out of the service because we got so sick of, and the men liked long hair, you know. They always liked long hair. You were supposed to wear regulation shoes and so forth, but when we got to Paris, they let us start letting us wear pumps to work. Yeah. And I never minded the regulations, so I didn't give it too much thought. The only thing I do remember in Africa that we were examined once a month, and I always had the feeling that it was to find out whether you were pregnant or not. You got a female examination once a month, which I think is a little bit out of the ordinary.
Were any women that you knew sent home because they were found to be pregnant?
We had two or three who got pregnant and went home.
I see. Were they given a dishonorable discharge, you suppose?
I don't know. I really don't know. I think they probably were. I know they at that time it was not considered a good thing to do.
Well, now, okay, let's bring you from Europe back home again.
Now, they sent us to Philip Morris, which is a great big debarkation, I guess you'd call it, point, which was a dismal place. There was nothing there to do except eat, and eating became the biggest thing. We would all get in line about an hour before meals, you know, and complain because we made up a song because there was only one meat. They'd only give you one meatball. We were used to all this luxury, and then we couldn't wait to get back, to get out of there. And they marched us down eventually to our ship. We were coming home on a ship, and it was a hospital ship. As a matter of fact, it was the sister ship to a ship that my brother had served on as a hospital corpsman during the war.
Wow.
And I came back on the Blanche Sigmund, and he was on the Huddleston, I think it was, and they were sister ships. But it looked like a little rowboat there. We all said, "It's awful small," and all the sailors were up there, and they were insulted because it looked so small to us.
Did it ride well?
It was okay. I never got seasick. I never missed a meal. But some of the girls, I think it's where they put you. I was pretty high. If they put you in the hold, I think it's worse. And some of the girls, we never saw them again until after we got in. And they looked like death warmed over.
I mean, they were in sick bay most of the time.
Well, they never got off their bed. Oh. They were so sick. And it did get a little rocky sometimes. I even remember some of the mess attendants being, you know, ill and not being able. But for some reason, I think I gained about 10 pounds. And we had milk for the first time in 2 years.
Well, you gained 10 pounds.
What on the ship.
Did that put you at?
I don't know, but it was, it didn't show very much because I was pretty, in good condition.
When you traveled, was most of your traveling are from one assignment to another by ship, or did you fly at any time?
We flew all the time, except coming home. We came home on a ship.
I flew.
Yeah, we flew all the time. We were with Air Transport Command. Mm-hmm. And there was no other way, anyhow. We flew. My first flight that I ever was on was my flight from Miami to Africa. I had never been on a plane before.
Is that so?
A lot of them hadn't been on a plane before.
Well, all right, and you went to what port? What entry?
We came into New York.
Into New York.
And we saw the Statue of Liberty, and they still, you know, when people came in, I don't know if you know that, but they had a boat that would come out. A lot of people would be on it. I guess they were USO people or something. Well, we had that. I had heard about it, and they were there. And I really can't remember exactly what happened. I know they examined us before we went off, and I remember the doctor, you know that depressor they put in your tongue? He forgot to change it, and he put it in my mouth so fast, and I got the most awful sore throat, and I was finally put in the hospital. I couldn't go home right away. I had a very bad sore throat, and I always thought that was the reason.
Well,
he had his tongue depressor, you know, he's going through it, and he forgot to throw that one away. And I said, oh, and it was too late, it was in my mouth. So I had to spend some time in the hospital. I really had a very
Had your group gone on?
They went on. And
What happened from then? Then did you travel to another place by yourself? A camp?
After I got out of the hospital, I hadn't gotten out of the service yet, and I hadn't made up my mind. Some of us were thinking of staying in. And I came home, and I was on leave for a little while. And then I came back, and I went to talk to the woman who was in charge of the Air Transport Command. She was an officer, and I don't remember her name. But she was not very encouraging. It's really strange. Because I felt that I would be a good candidate to stay in. But she says, I don't really think that there's going to be a women's group very much longer. She actually said that to me. She was very, she really didn't encourage me to stay in. And was sent to Fort Totten. And I was there for a very short time and decided, I met another WAC who was had been in the Pacific, and she was planning on going to college, and I had never thought about going back to school. And I guess she's the one who put the idea in my head. And we used to go into New York, and you could see all the plays for free when you were in the service. You'd go and ask for a ticket, and they had that. It was marvelous.
Oh, yeah.
And that was my first really introduction to New York City.
Uh-huh.
And we went to see several plays, and she was rather, nice person, and I don't even remember her name anymore, but she's the one who got me thinking about going to college. And then when I got back, I didn't know what to do with myself. And
Went back to your home in Massachusetts?
I went back. I was in Brookline. My mother was in Brookline, Massachusetts at that time. And I was there, and I was casting around for something to do, and I was getting letters from various girls, and some of them had already gone back overseas. They were in Japan, and I didn't know what to do, and I saw an ad that they were opening a new college at Boston University, and I called them, and I took the test, and evidently did very well, and I went to college.
Did you attend on the GI Bill?
On the GI Bill.
Do you remember exactly what year you were discharged from the Army?
Yeah, it was in June of 1946.
1946, I see. And did you attend just one college?
I went to Boston University for 4 years. And then after that I went back and worked for the government, for the Military Assistance Advisory Group in The Hague, and then later for the...
Oh, you went back to Europe.
Yes, okay. After I graduated in 1950. And I worked for the United States Military Assistance Advisory Group. And then I went to Berlin and worked for the Office of Special Investigations of the Air Force. And I worked 2 years overseas.
How do you compare your military service with your civilian service over here? Is there much
difference? Well, it was a lot of it was similar, but you had much more freedom. You weren't you didn't have to stick with your own class, as it were, you know, and
no restrictions.
Restrictions. I had about as good a time. I think that. The wartime was a different time for us. Everybody was in it. And you also had a feeling that you didn't know whether it was ever going to be over. You know, you lost sight of the future. Whereas when you became a civilian, it wasn't wartime. There were different people. Not everybody was in. Most people were back home trying to make a life out for themselves. But there were a lot of similarities.
I'm trying to follow your life, that the steps that brought you to Louisville. Now, from where you stopped, can you pick it up and just tell me how?
Okay. Well, both of my brothers were in college too. They went to college, and when the youngest one graduated, there was a lot of recruiting in those days of companies, and he was recruited by Carson Scott Peary or Peary. I never can remember the names, the big store in Chicago. So he went to live in Evanston, worked in Chicago. And then my other brother, who went to Tufts, when he graduated, he needed a job too. And he went to Chicago, and he got a job for Fairbanks Morse Scale Company. Well, then my mother, who was living with an aunt, I think, at the time, came with them to live, and she got ill. She was dying of cancer eventually, and that's how I happened to come back. I came back a little early. I was almost due to come home. After every 2 years, they sent you home, but I came home a little bit early because she was sick, and she eventually died. And I stayed in Chicago and worked in a big insurance company where I met my husband, and I got married in Chicago. And we were married for about 3 or 4 years. I had a little girl, and we got a divorce, and I needed to get away, and my aunt, I wanted to come back to Boston, and my aunt, who lived there, said she'd help me. So I went back to Boston and stayed there for a little while, and then she had moved away. I was there all alone, and Kathy was going into first grade, and you went to the first grade for only half a day. And I had had her in a little nursery school, which was very nice, but I had to have someone take care of her. So we came here because my cousin had moved here. Her husband, who had been recruited for Seagram's when he got out of the University of New Hampshire. That's, you know, what happened in those days. People moved around. And so that I came here.
Well, I think that just about finishes our tape, which gets you to Louisville.
Yeah.
Thank you a lot.